That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. On the program today, Ukrainian voices on the future of their home nation. We'll hear from an MP, a geopolitical analyst, and a cultural historian about the devastating war waged by their neighbour Russia, how it has changed the country, and how they one day hope to bring the war to an end. As the war in Ukraine enters its bloodiest phase yet, there's no shortage of experts in the West holding forth on how best to bring peace to the region. But what do the Ukrainian people themselves think? For this episode, we gathered three prominent voices from Ukraine to discuss it, and we also put some audience questions to them too. Here's our host, journalist, broadcaster and academic, Philippa Thomas, with more.
Hello and welcome to this event. This is dedicated to Ukrainian views on what is happening inside Ukraine and what the end game can or should be as the country continues to resist Russia's brutal invasion. All our speakers are Ukrainian or of Ukrainian heritage, and all of them join us today from inside Ukraine. So let's find out a little more first about where they are as they join us. Let's come first to Michael Bosacu, writer, global affairs analyst, and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Michael, where are you now? Where were you when the invasion began?
Good evening, and thank you for having me. I'm in Lviv, Ukraine, in the Western Ukrainian city that is very well known worldwide now, I think. And when just before the hostilities commenced, I was actually in Kyiv doing commentary and analysis, and then I moved over to Lviv. Hostilities started, and I've stayed here. But I have been back to Kyiv, and I've gone as far as Chernihiv to see the frontline effect of the Russian aggression.
Michael, looking forward to hearing much more from you. Olha Polyukhovich, literary critic and associate professor at the Department of Literature of the National University of Kyiv Mohyla Academy. Olha, where are you joining us from today?
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Philippa, for your introduction. During the first days of war, I fled my hometown near Kyiv, and now I'm in Rivne region, which is western Ukraine too.
And Kira Rudik, Ukrainian MP, leader of the Kholos, which is Voice Political Party. Kira, where are you joining us from? And tell us about the flags we can see standing proud behind you.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for having me. I'm joining you from Kyiv, and I'm proud to say that I have been here since the day one. I didn't leave anywhere except for one day in Bucha and Gostomel. I remain with my constituency, and I will be here for as long as I am needed. Actually, it's a funny thing about flags. So we have behind me the Ukrainian aims, right? We have Ukrainian flag, we have my party flag, Kholos or Voice, we have European Union flag, and we have NATO flags. It all represents like why are we fighting and what we need to achieve. But the most important is these flags are covering my windows. And what you cannot see right now are actually the tapes on the windows. And every window right now in any territory that can be hit by airstrike are actually covered with tapes. Because if there will be a hit behind me, then I can be easily killed by the glass fractures. And so this wouldn't happen. I also have flag as additional protection. And I can tell you quickly, right away, that just an hour ago, I was with my friend journalist who was at the building, near the building that was recently hit by the Russian missile. And she only had her windows taped in only one of her rooms. And so because of the airstrike and because of the shockwave, the rest of the glass was everywhere. And she actually hurt her legs, and it's a terrible, terrible situation. But this is our new reality. We are taping our glasses everywhere because we know that it could save our lives.
Thank you. It is your new reality. It reminds us how vulnerable you all are and the importance of the fact that you are speaking to us tonight from within Ukraine. And you'll not just be speaking to me, you'll be hearing from audience members. I'll be able to bring questions to you. And so to explain to those who are joining us, tonight's event runs for about an hour. And for the first 40 minutes or so, I'll be talking to our guests, but I want to be taking your questions as well. And you can start asking them now. It's pretty easy. You just click on the Ask Question button that's at the bottom of your screen. Under the video screens, you type in your question. If you want us to say your name as well, if you want me to identify you, just put your name, type your name in the box as well, and then press send. And that's how your questions will come in. I'll remind you as well partway through and as we open this up in the last 20 minutes of the event. But let's come back to our guests now, because what I want to ask you first, and Kira, I'll come back to you first, to sum up for us how you have experienced this war.
You know, our previous president once told me that there is no Stanford in the world that would teach you how to be a president during a war time, how to be a member of parliament during a war time, how to be a parent during a war time. So we are happy that we are alive. We are surprised that it's day 71, because I think nobody, and even ourselves, did not expect it to last for so long. We would have hoped for the quick victory, and the world would have thought that we would lose quickly. We have our lives changed tremendously, and we had been traumatized to the level that cannot be reversed. When you're asking me of how are we doing, the most painful thing that I can tell you is that, you know, we all are coming from the generation of 90s. We all have lived through the revolutions, through the poverty, and we hoped that we will raise a generation of kids that wouldn't know all of that, that we would spoil them and they will build a new country based on democracy and all the values that we will instill in them. And right now we failed those kids. Because now we have a generation of kids that know how to hide when there is an air raid siren. And we know who know and ask their parents, "Mommy, are we refugees?" Who know to cover their ears and open their mouths when they hear explosions. Who know all the atrocities of war. So this is how we are.
Olha, your war, your experience of war, what do you most need us to understand from the outside about what you've been going through?
What I found out, I was researching Ukrainian literature, and many writers underwent World War II, and when I was reading their stories, their memoirs, I could think that war is awful thing, but I could not imagine how it really is until the full-scale Russia-Ukraine war started. And during the first days of war, we've counted the days. So it's like 7th days of war, 8th days, 20, and so on. And now we stopped doing that. And it looks like Kira said, it's our new normal. I'm teaching online, and I also want to say, underline that my students spent 2 years online during the pandemic. because of COVID-19, and now they are living through war. And of course, it's very tough for them. But when I see how my colleagues from Kharkiv teaching from basements, from bomb shelters, it gives me hope, it gives me strength, and I can feel this resistance, and it really gives us hope in these desperate times. What we can do is just to continue what we are doing.
Michael, your thoughts on being plunged into one existential crisis after the last one? As Olga was saying, what particularly would you like us to understand from your point of view?
Sure. Well, I view this as part of the war that started in 2014. This is kind of an extension, but of course a much more violent one and on a much, much wider scale. But having spent a lot of time in eastern Ukraine in 2014 with the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission, including behind the front lines, I had seen firsthand the brutality of the Russian-backed thugs there. And the way they would shell populated centers indiscriminately. But I have to say that in a recent trip I took to Chernihiv, where I saw what the Russian forces did, I've been to many violent places around the world, as I'm sure you have, Gaza Strip, places like that, but nothing prepared me for that. I described the scene that I saw. It was a residential community pounded consistently by Russian bombs, and we're talking 250 to 500 pound bombs right in the middle of communities. It was a mix of a wildfire, a hurricane, and a war on top of that. You had, we actually saw teddy bears, dolls, toys in those bomb craters. That's how close they hit. Shredded teddy bears. Today, if I can give you a couple of vignettes, I'm in, as I said, in Lviv, right on the edge of the old town. Nearby me is what they call the garrison church. Not a day goes by, except for maybe one or two days for Easter, where a funeral doesn't take place. There are military funerals there every day. Today was one. Sometimes we have two. Sometimes we have three young men in the church at the same time, their families saying goodbye. I was there for one of them today. And just on the way to my flat here to talk to you, I passed by a, I would say, middle-aged serviceman in full uniform. He was on a park bench, just bent over twice, bawling his eyes out. It looked like he had just come from the front line. But these friends have asked me, just to wrap this part up, friends have asked me what it's like to be here. And I can't imagine what, Olya and Kira and others who are from here go through. My roots are from here, but I was born in Canada. But it's very much like a roller coaster ride. You can be happy right now because it's spring and things are blooming, but it just plunges in an instant when you see those types of funerals happening or talk to people what they're going through.
And Michael, the Russian President Vladimir Putin continues to insist, it's part of his rationale, that Russians and Ukrainians are brothers.
Complete nonsense. I had sensed in that rambling 5,000-word essay that he released last year that he was preparing to invade Ukraine. And I said it consistently that something's going to happen, and he did, because he has never got over the fact of the collapse of the Soviet Union. We all knew that his popularity was plummeting at home. Perhaps this was a bit of a distraction. I don't think it was the only reason. And also, he's getting on in age, and I think he wants to create a legacy among his own circle, among his own people, of conquering Ukraine and probably go even further, as a matter of fact. I think his end game is to redraw the security infrastructure of Eastern Europe. And that is one of the many reasons why the West has to do everything possible to give Ukraine the resources to push them back.
And we'll come back to that about what the West needs to do.
Sure.
But Olga, I want to talk to you next about the sense of Ukrainian identity, because, well, I want to hear your thoughts on whether there was a sense of Russian-Ukrainian brotherhood, sisterhood, and what's happening now to that?
Yes, it's the myth of Ukraine-Russia brotherhood or fraternal peoples is a part of Russian propaganda right now, and that's air raids.
We hear the sirens and may hear them again during this hour. Olha.
So I will continue if I may. It's a core narrative of their propaganda. And what is interesting in this myth is that Ukraine is a younger brother, is a brother who does not know what to do, and the duty of older brother or big brother in Orwellian sense is to explain the way how Ukraine should act, and using this myth when Putin and Russian army invaded Ukrainian Donbass in 2014, they said they wanted to protect Russian-speaking populations there, so to protect their brothers. And this myth of brotherhood was used since the beginning of the war in 2014 to justify Russian actions, Russian military aggression on Ukrainian territory.
So, Kira, now there are many campaigns and movements to pull down the statues, to think again about which authors, which artists, which historic figures are revered within Ukraine. What do you feel about that movement in your city, in Kyiv? It's happening now, isn't it? Bring down the statues of Russian figures.
Well, I do support it because my party is one of the initiators of that. You see, a couple of days ago, we had Boris Johnson talking to Ukrainian parliament online. It was a very important address because he said a key thing to our people. He said, well, we were wrong. We should have acted in 2014 when the war started, when the actual war started. We really didn't think that we should act now, but what we should have done that. And it was important not only for me, but for so many Ukrainians, because for 8 years, we have been like talking to every single person we know, saying, look what is happening to our country. They're attacking us from the east, they took the Crimea, and they would continue move forward. And the feeling that we had was like being a victim of a rape when there is a full room of people and everybody is looking to the side.
So Kira, and I'm using this analogy. You and those other voices were right to say this is going to be happening. Now that there is a brutal invasion underway, is your anger directed at Putin, at the Kremlin, or the entire Russian people?
It is directed to the entire Russian people, to the entire Russian culture. It is directed to everything that make them think that we could be brothers, everything that make them think that we can continue or have like a similar future, because they're using our past that was mutual because we were in the Soviet Union as one of the reasons to come back and conquer us and take our land and kill our people. This is why I believe what we have not done for the last 8 years, but we should do right now, is make sure that we wipe out pro-Russian parties who are telling Putin that he could invade and people here would support him. Moscow Patriarchy Church, which is working for Russians right now still. And everything that is related right now to our any conjunction that we could have, starting with the street names and ending with the statues and what is written in children's book, etc. If we want to become European Union, and we do want to become European Union, it was actually a vote that was written in Ukrainian Constitution in 2014. This is when the war started, that we want to be a part of European Union and NATO. And this is why Putin attacks us. So we need to become a world nation. We are already a world nation, but we need to make sure that we get rid of this path that is dragging right now us to this atrocity, to this cruelty that is happening to us. And I do believe that right now is the time for it. Because we were very democratic, we were very slow, we were very open-minded and trying to be nice and taking care of everybody's opinion beforehand. Right now is the time to make sure that we cut all the evil out. And this is what we are going to do, and this is what we are doing, not only in Kyiv, but in other cities. So we have Michael from Lviv. Michael, do you see any pro-Russian names left in Lviv?
I don't, but you know, I would go one step further, if I can say, is that I would also weed out, as part of the reconstruction redevelopment of Ukraine, the pro-Russian oligarchs who have been plundering relentlessly the economy, that it's no longer a oligarch-dominated economy, and that it's no longer a media landscape where oligarchs dominate and run their media, their own media stations in their own self-interest. But no, a lot of changes have happened. And I think, you know, as much as there is almost a quarter of a million migrants here in Lviv right now, many, many of them from the east, I think they're also realizing that, well, number one, I mean, this place is known for its hospitality, but number two is I think a lot of them are, for example, starting to learn Ukrainian and learn more about Ukrainian culture from this part of the country. So what my point here is that Putin indirectly has really boosted Ukrainian patriotism everywhere in Ukraine and as well as, of course, support around the world.
And Olha, I see you nodding at that. About that, you know, Putin having had completely counterproductive results there. Your thoughts on that, but also the idea of wiping out Russian culture and pro-Russian voices within Ukraine as an academic, as a literary academic. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I completely agree to Michael that Putin's Russian full-scale war on Ukraine just boosted Ukrainian identity and the sense of ourselves. And we can see now, for example, what Kira mentioned, changing names of streets, metro stations, dismantling monuments. It's very, I think, I regard it as a very positive process because historical reconsideration should occur. Because what we see in Russia, while during the decommunization since 2015, right after the Crimea annexation and start of the war in Donbas area, the monuments to Lenin were dismantled in the cities and towns of Ukraine. But what did Putin just before this invasion? He said that Lenin invented Ukraine. Absolutely absurd and nonsense, claim. You know, it goes from they did not reconsider their history, their cultural heritage, because Russia never had truth and reconciliation commission. On the contrary, it did many crimes towards Ukrainians in 20th century. And these crimes, they booster their imperial identity and they continue to invade other countries. I mean, it's not only about Ukraine, but we can think here about Syria, Georgia, Moldova. So it's the part of their identity. And coming back to Putin's claims that Lenin invented Ukraine, why Russian army was so desperate to capture Kyiv? Why it ruined Chernihiv? Because if you look at the history of these cities, Chernihiv and Kyiv are much older cities than Moscow. Moscow even did not exist when these cities were great cultural, educational centers of the area. And without like this part, Russia is less stronger, less potent, and the reconsideration of the past, both historical and cultural, is very important today because we should not forget that Ukraine was under the Soviet occupation almost 20th century. And it was imposed, like, why this central metro station is called Tolstoy station. I don't understand. It's just as it is.
So, Olha, let me pick up from your point. Something I want to put to Michael. We're hearing your defiance, your anger, the resurgence of pride in Ukrainian identity, sense of nationalism. So, Michael, let me ask you this first. How then does President Volodymyr Zelensky get to the point where he negotiates with the Russians to bring peace to you all?
Right. Just as a prelude to that, what is happening right now, for example, in places like Mariupol and surrounding places, Kherson, is what the Russians are trying to do is continue that liquidation of Ukrainian culture by I saw with my own eyes in Chernihiv, bombing libraries, replacing curriculum, introducing the ruble, getting rid of the Ukrainian language. It's part of their active military strategy right now, and it's really important to point that out. They want to go to the part as far as by next Monday, May 9th, their so-called Victory Day, to have a parade in Mariupol, and they will do everything possible to make that happen. That's a very chilling thought. In terms of what can Mr. Zelensky do, I think he said to Fareed Zakaria, is I'm going to do whatever it takes to save lives. But it's a very sensitive topic in terms of where he goes with negotiations. I sense right now is the West is not pushing peace talks or negotiations. I think what the West is encouraging Ukraine to do and backing it up with very lethal and high-tech weaponry is to push back the Russians as far as possible, possibly to the point of booting them out of illegally annexed Crimea and Donetsk, and then finishing them off as much as possible. As much as we may agree with that strategy, a fear of mine is the potential massive loss of lives in the meantime. So I think everyone has to think about strategies very carefully. What would make a big difference right now, which would give Ukraine a huge upper hand, is what we heard right now. We heard those sirens, and it's very possible, in fact, extremely possible, that missiles are flying our way as we speak. They were here on Monday. The only way to restore a sense of security among Ukrainians and, you know, more control over Ukrainian land is to give Ukraine the technology, the weaponry, to be able to close its own skies, because the West clearly doesn't have the spine to do that on their own. President Zelensky has been begging for that. I mean, there is that very high-tech Iron Dome system that has been used very effectively in Israel. I don't know why that's not considered for use here, but the West has to understand is that unless they're given that ability, this is how the Russians operate with persistent brute force. Their artillery conquers and their infantry occupies. So we have to prevent that brute force from destroying civilian lives and communities and infrastructure.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient, so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
Kira, brute force needs to be met with closed skies and more.
So, first on negotiation. I personally and my colleagues in the parliament, we do not believe in peaceful negotiations with Russia. You know why? Because we already had peaceful negotiations with Russia for 8 years. And you know what the only thing was that Russia couldn't do? Step one, ceasefire. So right now the question is, if we have these peaceful negotiations, if they end up at something, like who would be the person or the country or the unity of countries that would make sure that Putin keeps his word? And when I was talking to my fellows in United Nations, I told them to look outside the building and see if there is a line of leaders trying to get in and say, okay, let me be the person who vouches for Putin. But we all know that this is not happening. And so right now, all peaceful negotiations discussions should start with the question, who would be the security guarantor for the Russia that they wouldn't break their word? Because we know that for sure that they would break their word. Because right now, when there were those peaceful negotiations, and I'm quoting that, because while there were peaceful negotiations coming up, there were rapes in Bucha, there were atrocities in Chernihiv, my people were killed in Mariupol and throughout the countries. There has been missiles through all over the country, and people continue to die. Well, Russia said, oh, we want the peaceful negotiations. This is the first point. The second point on how it could end. The only way is for us to win. Yeah, this is the truth. And we would need more weapons. We would need more sanctions from the West. And we would need more and more support, including financial support. Because no matter what we are talking about as an endgame, weakening Russia to the point that they wouldn't be able to continue, or Ukraine taking back all the territories and revolution in Russia, like whatever we are discussing, we know that it will be long-term and it will need to have a combined effort. Because you see how hard it is going even to weaken Russia out right now. You see how hard it is going to unite the democratic countries to impose more and more sanctions. You see how slowly mindsets change to give Ukraine the weapons that we need. It's been two months of begging, crying, negotiating, knocking on all of the doors to let the countries that do have weapons that we need to give them to us. And you know what? These weapons are still in transit. So right now, And I want to give you just this quick and very important example. Right now, the world is still in crisis. The first good crisis after the Second World War. And this crisis is, are we for the rules and democratic values and things that we all believe in, or are we for the effectiveness and destroying evil when we see it? And I can tell you, in Ukrainian parliament, we have the same debate, the same question, because we have pro-Russian parties. And we all were, for a couple of years, we all were saying, oh, but they were democratically elected. They are also representatives of the people, so we cannot just push them out. Well, you know what? We have come to overcome this crisis. We know that we can, and we are pushing them out.
I want to ask you a question, which I don't say lightly, because I am sitting safely at a desk in London. You are there with the air raid sirens. You spoke about the children who are now having to live their lives, you know, knowing what to do when they hear the sirens, always fearing that their whole lives could be blasted in an instant. If the only way forward is for us to win, as you just said, those children may have to spend their teenage years, their young adulthoods in a state of war. The price is very high.
The price would be even higher if these children will grow up and then they will have to face what I'm facing right now and what my colleagues are facing right now. The goal is not to make these children to have another war with Russia in 5 to 10 years. Do you think that Russia will stop right now? If, like, imagine that they, like, just went away. They will be collecting more and more gas and oil money. They will be still having this idea of rebuilding Russian Empire or Soviet Union or whatever the hell they are rebuilding. And they will be just getting more and more forces to then throw it on somebody else. Look at their actions in Kazakhstan, in Georgia, in Belarus, previously in Finland, in Ukraine. This country and this nation can only exist by expanding and hoping for this a greater idea of the imperialism.
And for these reasons.
And this is absolutely against of what we say.
Because of what you're saying, Kira, Michael, I want to put it to you, is this then a proxy war against Russia? Is this the West or the outside, not the entire outside world, you know, a large coalition of global interests against Russia? Is that simply what we're seeing?
Sure. Well, I used to call it that, but now the Russians are now using that term of proxy war, so it's not very politically correct. But let's be clear, is that Ukraine finds itself as a state, a nation, a fully-fledged nation in between Russia and NATO's eastern flank. And that in the absence of Western boots on the ground here, the West is expecting Ukraine to fight this war. I do have to underline something, though, and it's something Kira said, which I agree with her 100%, is that I was with the OSCE in 2014, 2015, when we negotiated successive so-called ceasefires with the Russian-backed thugs, and not one of them held. And, you know, it was a really sad thing. It puts us in a sad, sad place as humanity, I think. Why? Because at least in places like Colombia, in places like Myanmar sometimes even, you can negotiate for opposing forces to put down their weapons for days of tranquility or vaccinations or things like that. They will do it, and you know they will do it. Because they've made their pledges and their belief. But here, you can't. And as Kira said, even in those humanitarian corridors, they are not respected. So the other thing here, quickly, is we're further in a bad place as humanity when tyrants, dictators, totalitarian leaders don't know where red lines are. They don't know where the West's red lines are. And I think that didn't start, but the Crimea was one. Afghanistan was another. The Syria chemical weapons, exactly. And Putin is that type of character, this twisted mind where he probes and probes and probes for soft tissue for as far as he can go and then fights back. So the only thing people like him understand is brute force. So we are, as I said many times over the past 48 hours, we're in a very difficult phase of the war right now, where a lot of smart people have to get together and I think this through, because putting weapons, sending weapons here, I don't think will do the trick. A lot more is going to be needed, aside from also closing the skies to these long-range weapons that can go all the way from the Caspian Sea as far as here to near the Polish border.
Olha, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the point Kira was making about, you know, if we don't sort it out once and for all now, Putin will come back, the Russians will come back. You know, it's happened, it'll happen again. In a sense, Ukraine being where it is and the richness of Ukraine makes it vulnerable. It's that idea of it being a prisoner of geography.
So I completely agree with my colleagues, with Kira and with Michael, that West should do as much as possible, must do as much as possible to help us to protect ourselves from Russian military aggression, giving us high-tech, modern weapons, imposing more severe sanctions on Russia. And it's true that we do not believe in agreements with Russia, because if we think about war during 2014-2021, despite the Minsk agreements to cease the fire, still 14,000 civilians and military were killed in eastern Ukraine. Can you imagine this number? And how many IDPs we have in Ukraine? Broken families, broken lives, destroyed cities. And it's just awful. Some of my students, they fled Donetsk and Luhansk regions in 2014, and now they are fleeing once more. So it means that Putin and Russia, they just repeat the history. And if he won't win now, of course he will come back. No doubt here. And Ukraine is coming back to your question to geography. It has a unique position between East and West. And what we also were recalling when the war just started, the Budapest Memorandum of 1994, when Ukraine dropped its nuclear weapons in assurance for security on its territory from Great Britain, from the US, and from Russia. And see what we have now. We cannot protect ourselves. We do not have enough weapons. And that what we... urge West to do, to help us. But of course, we have hope and we must win. We do not have other option.
If I can bring in one of the questions, we've got quite a few questions coming in from our audience. And I just want to remind those of you who are with us now that under the video screen, there is a section that says there's an ask a question button, and you can do just that. Type in your question, type in your name if you want to, and then press send. And we're watching the questions coming in. And when you say there is no other option, one of the very heartfelt questions that has just come in, I want to read to you all, says, while I'm full of admiration for your courage and resilience, for your physical and spiritual resistance to the invading Russians, I feel ambivalent. Putting the rhetoric of defiance to one side, would it not on humanitarian grounds be better to save possibly tens of thousands of Ukrainian lives and surrender places in the east, some of the eastern areas, as they are inevitably going to fall to the Russian steamroller? I can imagine the emotion coming up in all of you at this point, but I just want you to look at that question. Kira, first, what do you want to say to that member of the audience?
This is not the first time when these questions are asked. And it's all obviously very hard to answer them without like an extreme emotion. But if we are talking logic, the people who have seen what happened in Bucha, people who have seen what happened in Mariupol, people who have seen what happened in temporarily occupied territories on the east that were under Russians' reign for the last 8 years. They can say that we need and we would fight till the end. I can tell you about the kind of peaceful regions that were under temporary Russian occupation. For the 8 years, all the human rights were dismissed and disobeyed there. So people are living without the rule of law, without the respect to the basic democratic values and their rights as humans. What happened, the atrocity that happens in my country right now, you probably have seen them on TV, on the internet. You know what we are talking about. So how could one hope that if we give up those territories to Russia, that they would become suddenly teddy bears and fluffy democratic people who would say, okay, now we are done and let's put a democracy there. No, it will be terror and horror and death and destruction. And we are not giving up our people to that.
Michael.
I have been arguing for the longest time that it's far better for the West to take decisive actions. Don't depend on sanctions that aren't working, but take decisive action to bring this to an end on the West terms rather than on Mr. Putin's terms. Because if it does not do that, and it hasn't done that yet, tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of lives are at stake. Giving up those territories to the Russian side, well, we're seeing what that is like right now in real time. It's playing itself out. The Russian definition of evacuation of civilians from Mariupol is to put them through so filtration centers where they're harassed, tortured, sent to Russia. The numbers are horrific, Philippa. If you listen to Mr. Zelensky, I think he threw out the number of about 500,000, estimated 500,000 Ukrainians who have been forcibly deported to Russia. The Russians claim 1 million, although they don't call it forcible deportation. So it's a very chilling thing. And of course, it brings back memories of the Soviet gulag, of those times when people like me, when I was younger, we protested in front of Soviet embassies and, you know, for freedom of Ukraine and for an end of the liquidation of the church. So it's a very chilling thing to see this playing out right now. And again, I'll reference what I said earlier, what we saw with our own eyes in Russian-controlled Donetsk and Luhansk since 2014, of the indiscriminate bombing of basements that were run by the Russian thugs to torture, including journalists, into submission. Many, many others, people who were identified as intellectuals, things like that. So it's a very brutal occupation that would await people who would find themselves there.
I'm interested in finding out from you, whether the idea of a partition to save lives is actually unthinkable. And Olga, I want to ask you not about your view, but whether there is even a debate about this among Ukrainians.
It's a very complicated question, but I would say Ukrainians are ready to protect their independence, their freedom, and their choice. Because we did not invite anyone here to come to Ukraine to kill our civilians, to ruin our beautiful cities. Ukraine is independent, sovereign, European country. And what I want also to add, why the resistance is so powerful in Ukraine, coming back to what Michael has already said about 20th century. You see, when I read in the news that Russians do not allow humanitarian corridors to resupply Mariupol and other Ukrainian cities with food, water and medicine, and the child is dying because of dehydration, what I remember is the Holodomor, or Great Famine, of 1933. When 4 million or even more, it's impossible to count, were killed by hunger in those eastern regions of Ukraine. And when I see now this illegal forced deportation, what I am remembering is the forced deportation of Crimean Tatars during the World War II. And, you know, and this now emigration, when probably you know, and Michael, who lives in Lviv right now, that how many Ukrainians left the country? 3 million, 5 million. It's a large number. And we had it after World War II. Those who were decent, who opposed the communist regime, fled the country. And the Ukrainian diaspora is now one of the biggest in the world because of the communist rule, because of the Soviet occupation of Ukraine in the 20th century. That's why it's very important to continue our struggle. We are ready for that.
Sorry, let me bring in Kira first on this. I want to ask as well about the huge sacrifices being made by people of Ukraine and inside Ukraine. What Ukraine's allies should be prepared to sacrifice? There's a question just come in from Jane saying Ukraine's foreign minister has said any country that refuses to join the oil embargo against Russia is complicit in war crimes. And she says, isn't this a harsh judgment on governments that just want to keep energy supplies secure for their people? Kira.
Look, what we are dealing with right now. While Putin is committing atrocities in my country, killing people, raping women and children, destroying and committing all the crimes on the crime and on the war crimes list, European countries continue paying Russia for gas and oil $1 billion a day. Billion. So while we are talking with you today, like today, the billion went into Russia. So Putin right now can't afford not only war in Ukraine, but probably a couple of more wars, and would be able to afford that. So you cannot be then saying on one hand, okay, we just want to be nice and stand for the democratic values at the same time. Because the idea that all the democratic countries have is that you cannot be attacking sovereign country, right? You cannot start the war because you want to do so. So the question is the Western world ready to make the sacrifice to stop the evil? And if not ready, then it's allowing this evil to go forward. I want to come back to an important point of Budapest Memorandum. In 1994, my country gave up on the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world, which is for the security guarantees from United Kingdom, United States, and Russia, and for the guarantees of sovereignty and all that. And you see what's happening right now. So the question is, what are the countries planning to do? Do they want for this war, for these atrocities to continue and allow that to continue? Or do they want to stop that? And I don't think that there is a middle ground. All the ideas and illusions, there is a middle ground, and you can be good and on one hand and then support Russia by paying for their gas and oil on the other hand. It just cannot be true. It's the things that are contradict to each other. This is why if we want to end this war and make sure that it would not be repeated again, it needs to be a united front from all the European countries, United States, Canada, United Kingdom, on sanctions on Russia, not only coal, but oil and then gas. It needs to be a united effort on giving Ukraine the weapons that we need to fight. And our chunk in this is that the war with one of the largest aggressors in the world is happening on our land, and it's happening with our lives that are in stake. And if we lose, you know what the next question would be? It's Putin continuing to rebuilding Russian empire. And then he will go to Poland, to Baltic countries, and so on. And if we are talking about that it could be a middle ground, then give me an answer of what is the plan of those countries. Because I know the plan for my countries. We will be standing up and fighting.
Many more questions coming in. And given that you just referenced the fact that Ukraine had a hugely significant nuclear arsenal and gave it up, I want to put to you, Michael, this question. How does the panel rate the risk of a Russian nuclear attack?
I've actually been asked that on air a few times, and I have said that we cannot underestimate Mr. Putin's actions or intentions, rather. He does keep that option on the table. You hear the nuclear saber rattling of using nuclear weapons, but also chemical or biological weapons. I think a more likely scenario will probably be chemical. And the reason they would turn to those weapons is because they're not able to launch a full-scale deployment anymore of the Russian armed forces. But I think what they will probably do in a act of desperation, and the West has to be ready for this, is probably strike a chemical facility. In fact, there's one right outside Donetsk that we've been talking about for many, many years, the Donetsk water filtration plant, where there's a lot of chlorine. And we've always said a big fear of the OSCE was if one of the inaccurate Russian missiles hits that, you're going to have a huge disaster and lots of death on your hands. So they will do that, and then you have perhaps plausible deniability. But that's their way of operating. So that is why, I've been arguing it's better to deal with this and end it sooner on our own terms rather than on Mr. Putin's terms, because we don't know what he will do with that twisted mind.
Olha, another question that's just come in to us is, does the panel envisage a war of attrition lasting years, even decades? I'm having a little glitch here, but I'm hoping that you can hear me. So your thoughts first, Olha, on whether you're prepared to countenance a war of attrition that could last for many years.
I would say that we don't have any illusions, because Russia is unfortunately our neighbor, and we know our enemy at least a little more than West. And it's this question is for sure connected to the previous one. So each day I read about the deaths of our soldiers in my region where I live. So I'm in local news, and each time I see this news, I ask myself, what they died for. And it's impossible to stop now, because the price is very high. The very existence of this flag behind me is paid by the blood of my compatriots, by the blood of soldiers, brave Ukrainian soldiers, innocent civilians, including children. And we are ready for different scenarios. But bringing back to this question about nuclear terrorism, so from the very first days of war, Russians went to the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, terrorizing the whole world and then shelling another power plant in Ukraine. And you see, it was the world know about great disaster at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in 1986. It was at the time when Ukraine was a part of the Russian world. We do not want to be the part of the Russian world anymore. We are an independent, sovereign country, and we are ready to fight and to protect ourselves as long as it's necessary.
That point you make, we do not want to be part of the Russian world anymore. I'm hearing that from all of you loud and clear, and know that you're speaking for many, many more. One of the questions that's just come in from Julia says, if Ukraine were to join the EU, so moving away definitively from that Russian sphere, would that not be another provocation for Mr. Putin to clamp down on Ukrainian freedom? Kira, you've got the EU flag behind you.
I've got it here, EU and NATO flags, because they represent the will of Ukrainian people. The will that we want to move towards the democratic values and away from the autocracy, that we want to move towards the future and all the ideas that come with it, against the past and rebuilding of whatever empire they are rebuilding. Our ideas of free markets, free trades, liberal values, all these points, they are in this idea of joining the EU. And when we are talking about provoking Putin on this or that, it's actually the same thing that my colleague said about the nuclear weapons. The West is so afraid that Putin would launch nuclear weapons that they were delaying the weapons that should have been coming to Ukraine. And right now saying, okay, we wouldn't do that not to provoke Putin. As a member of parliament in the country that has been at war with Russia for 8 years, I can tell you right away, there is no particular influence that the world could have on Putin or his plans. His plans are the plans. They are what they are, and he will be going with them. He is crazy. Nobody knows what's in his mind. But we have this fantastic saying in Ukrainian language. It says we have to do our own thing, and our own thing is joining EU as our people wish, making sure our country is strong with the international support, making sure that Russia is weakened out, so then at some point they're out of their missiles, they're out of their weapons, they're out of ability to attack us. That they are concentrated on their internal problems rather than external problems, that they are in default. This is the things that we can control and we need to be concentrated. Putin can launch nuclear weapons. He can attack our nuclear plants. He can throw millions of soldiers into Ukraine. But it does not change of what we need to do. We need to do our own thing, is getting stronger, moving with our direction, and not having those hesitations, would we or would we not provoke him? Because in this matter, the decision could be, okay, so not to provoke him, let's just like sit down quietly and hope for good. This is not how Ukrainians work. This is not how we are wired. We will be fighting.
So stop thinking about the way that President Putin might react. Stop worrying about whether you're provoking him. I have a question here I want to put to you, Michael, which is it even worth talking to him? The question is, people like President Macron, are they right to maintain contact with Vladimir Putin? Or is there no point anymore? I mean, Michael, is there a point in terms of sending the message, at least, standing up?
I don't think so. You can do that through the Russian ambassador in Paris or wherever you come from. And I think it was a mistake, and I said it on air, for Peter Maurer, who I respect, of the ICRC, to go to Moscow, and as well as Secretary General Guterres of the UN. I think, you know, the problem a lot of Western leaders have, and my friend Michael Vatrikiotis, I think, agrees with me on this, is that Western sanctions happen to be more of a tool for politicians to pat themselves on the back and said, oh, look, we've done something and we've got everyone together. But those sanctions against Russia are so wide right now, or thin, you could drive a truck through them. We have to get to a point where, as Kira said, there's a united front where the Gulf states, India, even China, are all together on the sanctions. We have to get to a point where if you're a Russian oligarch and you want to go on vacation, you basically have two options, perhaps. North Korea, Pyongyang, I hear, is nice in the summertime. And then also those artificial islands that the Chinese are building, illegally building in the South China Sea. I hear it doesn't go below 35 Celsius there in the summertime. But that's where we have to get. But when I hear, and I have lots of friends in Turkey, and I respect, you know, the country a lot, but when I hear them starting a separate airline to bring millions more Russian tourists to Turkey, that worries me a bit. And I'm worried again also about India's non-alignment position when it comes to oil and energy, stuff like that.
Michael, my television training is coming in, and that we are finishing, yes. But I want to quote something to all three of you. One of the points that's been made by a member of our audience, I think you need to hear. She says, it's just a comment, not a question. I'm the granddaughter and daughter of war refugees from Central Europe who fled Soviet aggression after the Second World War. The suffering and horror so eloquently articulated by your guests continue to resonate in my family generation to generation. It is to despair to see history continue to repeat itself. We've heard so much from all of you that's been so powerful. You've talked about the only way is for us to win. There is no middle ground. The only thing he understands is brute force. We hear your determination. And it's been a real honor to be able to talk to the three of you in this event for Intelligence Squared. So at that point, I have to say, with thanks for those who sent questions that I haven't been able to get in, my thanks to Michael Bosaku, to Olha Polyakovich and Kira Rudik, to our audience, and also to Intelligence Squared.